The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, Howard Zinn, is a historian, playwright, and social activist. He was a social worker, a shipyard worker, an Air Force bombardier before he went to college under the GI Bill and received his PhD in history from Columbia University. While serving as chair of the history department at Spelman College, Zinn was deeply involved with the civil rights movement, and later, while teaching history at Boston University, Zinn became a leader in the movement to end the war in Vietnam. Howard Zinn has received the Thomas Merton Award, the Eugene V. Debs Award, the Upton Sinclair Award, and the Lannan Literary Award. He's the author of numerous books, all of great importance, most famously, A People's History of the United States. Most recently, along with Anthony Arnov, he has co-edited a book, Voices of a People's History of the United States. It's my great pleasure to welcome Howard Zinn to Media Matters.
Oh, Bob, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's really an honor to have you, Howard. And we've got a lot of callers. I know we're going to want to call in and have questions. So let me start by just talking about the book. I just got my hands on it. People's History of the United States, I think, has become sort of a major volume for people to understand a much more critical and nuanced view of U.S. history. What's the idea behind Voices of a People's History of the United States?
Well, what led to the publication of Voices is that, Dan Simon of Seven Stories Press, Anthony Arnov, a friend of mine, an editor, and I, maybe almost simultaneously, got the idea that People's History of the United States contains a lot of sort of interesting and juicy quotations from, you know, all sorts of people who are not usually quoted in orthodox histories. And we thought maybe those were the most interesting things in my book and that we ought to expand on them and produce a book simply of those documents, of those voices, of the voices of Las Casas, so blowing the whistle on Columbus, of fugitive slaves sort of sending letters back to their masters who were asking them to return to slavery since they were treated so well, of striking women, young women mill workers in the textile mills of New England, anti-war agitators and dissidents of all kinds. So we thought, yeah, let's do a book which is, you know, simply a book of those kinds of voices. So the result is this I must confess, big book, which starts with Las Casas in the 15th century and goes all the way up to the present time. Goes up to the Rodriguez family who lost a son in the Twin Towers on 9/11, and who write a letter, which we produce in the book, who write a letter to President Bush saying, we do not think, and we don't think our son would want that the United States should retaliate for the attack on the Twin Towers, retaliate with violence, going to war. You know, and it goes all the way up to the present, to the war in Iraq, to the voice of a soldier from the 101st Airborne who doesn't want to go back to Iraq and explains why he doesn't believe in this war.
Howard, as I looked through the book and I was reading it, I mean, it reminded me again, I think, of the influence a lot of your work has been not only to clarify how American history actually developed and to give a different perspective on it from sort of a dominant perspective, that this sort of an unfolding of some sort of divine pattern, but also there's always a sense in reading your work that things could be different, could have been different, and could be different today, that things are very much up for grabs if we organize.
Yes.
And I was struck in the last one of the last entries in the book, you have a nice piece by Kurt Vonnegut called Cold Turkey, which was actually published just in May of 2004. And he has a line in there, and for some of our, I'm sure most of our listeners are well aware of Kurt Vonnegut, but he's an octogenarian. He's been around a while.
Yeah.
And he says he's 81 at the time of writing this. And he writes in there, one of his sentences, he goes, "I now know that there is not a chance in hell of America's becoming humane and reasonable, because power corrupts us and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Human beings are chimpanzees who get crazy drunk in power." What do you make of that?
I make of that that this is Kurt Vonnegut. That is, Kurt Vonnegut tends to talk in complicated ways. By complicated ways, I mean, on the one hand, he will express absolutely dire feelings about our future. Oh, we don't have a chance. And doom is around the corner. On the other hand, he will say, and I've heard him say this, that we mustn't think that human beings are simply naturally violent and evil. And he says, you know, there are people who believe in original sin, and this gives them a very cynical view of the world. He says, but I believe also in original virtue. So he's talking about the capacity of people, the basic innate capacity of people to do good. So I think, you know, a lot of what Kurt Vonnegut says, of course, he says tongue-in-cheek. He says in a way that, you know, needs to be placed along other things that he says. He tends to exaggerate because he's a novelist.
No, but the reason I raised it, because it's a lovely piece, by the way, and Vonnegut's a terrific writer. Mm. The reason I raise it is that I would say your work tends to be optimistic. I mean, as I read you and have read your pieces, it's critical and no less aware of the problems we face in the here and now. But there's always a sense that things can change for the better if we organize.
Well, I think my optimism, you know, it's not based on a kind of foolish romanticism. I don't like to think that, of course, but I think it's based on historical evidence that people are capable if they organize, if they act, if they persist. People are capable of bringing about change, and we've seen that historically, and it takes that kind of historical perspective, not to be made pessimistic by what we see around us at any given moment. As you know, you look at the history of the anti-slavery movement, and you look see how in the 1830s there were a handful of abolitionists, and maligned not just in the South, but maligned in the North. And then there was a truth about their message, and the truth began to come through to the American people, so that by the eve of the Civil War, in fact, by the 1850s, the message of the abolitionists, which had been so sort of marginalized, put aside, became popular throughout the North, so that when they were arrested for violating the Fugitive Slave Act, the juries found them not guilty. And it was that growth of popular sentiment in the North, started by this very small group of people whose position at first looked hopeless. It was this great movement which brought about, really, the atmosphere in which Lincoln could present his Emancipation Proclamation, which Congress could pass the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And we've seen that again and again in history. We've seen the labor movement, again, facing enormous odds on all sides, facing not only the corporations, but facing the power of the government behind the corporations. But we've seen the labor movement organize and win the eight-hour day. We saw them at the turn of the century winning in Lawrence, Massachusetts, against the power of the textile companies. We see them in the 1930s defeating these enormously powerful entities like Ford and General Motors and U.S. Steel. And, of course, in more recent times, we've seen the people of the South, black people in the South, again, apparently powerless, working against tremendous odds, and building a movement which transformed the South and transformed the country on the matter of race. And of course, we saw it during the war in Vietnam. We saw a small movement against the war, feeling very often hopeless because of, they were up against, you know, the mightiest military machine in the world and the mightiest organs of propaganda. And yet, the movement against the war persisted and persisted, and the truth came out, and the war came to an end.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today on Media Matters. My name is Bob McChesney. I'm your host here on WILL AM 580. This is a live show, so we do have phone lines, and we will take callers in a few minutes. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Howard, I'm going to want to talk with you later about the war in Iraq and the current political situation, but I'd like to just do one more sort of big picture question, if I can, right now. Much of the history of progressive politics, not only in the United States but in the world, has been battling against capitalism, has been battling against the inequality and injustice that is seen as arising from capitalism. And for much of U.S. history, and certainly internationally it's the case as well, has been striving for a post-capitalist world, a socialist world. As you know, during the course of your lifetime, communism has faded away during the course of most of our lifetimes. Can we think in terms of a post-capitalist world now, or is everything we're fighting for just variations of capitalism?
I think it's very important to think of a world beyond capitalism. Capitalism clearly has failed. Capitalism has enormously magnified the technology and the clear quantity of goods in the world. But capitalism has failed to distribute those goods in an equitable way. So that here we are with an amazing technology at our grasp, and yet, you know, 14 million children die each year for lack of water and food. Capitalism, and in the United States, the most successful capitalist country, this very, very wealthy nation cannot give health care to 40 million people, cannot take care of the impoverished fifth of the children in this country who, you know, grow up poor. So capitalism has failed. I think we do have to think in terms of it's something I would call democratic socialism, that is, to distinguish it from the false socialism represented by the Soviet Union and by other countries which claimed to be socialist. But I think we do have to think in terms of a society which isn't based on corporate profit, where things are produced on the basis of what people need and not on the basis of what is most profitable for big business. I think we have to think in terms of a future society in which the wealth of the country and the wealth of the world is distributed in an equitable way, in which people's basic necessities are met. We need an ideal beyond capitalism, because the capitalism, the so-called free market, has been disastrous for most of the people of the world.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today. We have a full bank of callers who'd like to speak with Professor Zinn, so let's go right to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hello. You're a World War II veteran like Kurt Vonnegut and a historian. What did you think or how did you feel about the inauguration and the inaugural address, the kind of democracy that the president was talking about in his ownership society?
Bush was talking in his inaugural address about spreading liberty and democracy around the world. And I would argue that, you know, despite the fact that there was that moment of history in World War II, you know, when the United States and Britain and Russia sort of stopped the drive of Hitler, and liberated people from Nazism, the history of the United States has been a history of violent expansion. Not bringing liberty, not bringing democracy. Starting with the annihilation of Indian tribes in this country, going on to at war with Mexico to expand our territory, going on to move into the Caribbean, into Cuba and Puerto Rico, and then to fight a bloody war in the Philippines, and then to send Marines into Central America again and again, and, you know, down to our time, and the millions of people killed in the war in Vietnam and in Korea. The history of our country is hardly a history of bringing democracy or spreading liberty. And the only way that Bush could get away with statements like that is to a people deprived of history. And what this suggests is that the historical education that is given to our young people is really a very sad and inadequate. And the media, and I know that this is a program that talks a lot about the media does a terrible job about in failing to give people the historical perspective so they can react to Bush's inaugural address simply by repeating his words, but not subjecting his words to any kind of critical scrutiny, including placing his words against the evidence of history.
Howard, has the teaching of American history or history in general in our schools, our K through 12 and our high schools, junior high schools, improved over the course of your professional lifetime, or is it about the same, or has it gotten worse? Can you generalize about that?
I think I'm always willing to generalize about everything.
Good.
But I think it has improved. That is, it has improved because there are now thousands and thousands of teachers around the country, and many of them maybe were affected by the movements of the 60s. Many of these teachers were maybe some of them are veterans of the war in Vietnam, but many of them were alive in the 1960s and were influenced by the social movements of that time. And so there are thousands of teachers now in the country who will teach. They'll teach courses on war and peace. They'll teach about the Vietnam War. They'll teach about Christopher Columbus in a way that exposes him for his genocidal acts in the Caribbean. But I must say, you know, this is not a majority of the teachers of the country. The educational system is still largely a conservative system. But I point to the changes that have been made, and there have been changes for the better. I point to them as evidence that it is possible for education to change. It is possible for teachers to be bold and not be subservient to their department chairs or their or the, you know, school committees or the textbook publishers. It's possible for teachers to strike out on their own and teach their students to be critical, independent thinkers. And I've been encouraged when I go around the country and encounter teachers to see how many teachers and how many students are showing the effects of a more critical kind of education.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I'm going to make sure we get to all the callers who call in. So for those of you who just tuned in, Howard Zinn is the legendary historian and playwright and social activist, author of many books, most famously A People's History of the United States. He also has a new book out with Anthony Arnov, co-edited, Voices of a People's History of the United States, just out with Seven Stories Press, which is a 600-page collection of really extraordinary writings from the time of Columbus to literally 2004. Voices of opposition in the United States includes people, some well-known, some not known at all, poetry, musical lyrics. It's really quite an extraordinary volume. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hello, Professor Zinn. Thank you for your people's history and for your activities as a public speaker. Your comments just now, both of yours, anticipate part of my question. I would imagine that the pressures on textbook publishers are such that we don't get some of the history that we need, and the good teachers would probably have to bring in supplemental materials to get more information across. I look back at my college textbook now, and I see that there was no mention of U.S. Intervention in Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54, for example. My question is, relates to the burning question that I think a lot of Americans don't want to know the answer to. Why do they hate us? And I wonder how close we would ever come to holding what South Africa and Guatemala did, South Africa with perhaps more success, a truth and reconciliation process in which we'd come to terms with the truth of our history. You've mentioned the Columbus era. That's great. How close could we come to doing that?
All right, thank you.
Well, yeah, you, the caller mentioned, used the word hate to describe the way so many people in the world look upon the United States as a result of what we have done in the world, as a result of the democratic governments we've overthrown, of the tyrannical governments we have supported, and so it's not hard to understand why there should be such a negative view of the United States, considering what our foreign policy has been. I must add that I don't think these people who are angry at the United States are angry at the American people, because I think they do understand that there is a very, very large part of the American population that opposes government policy. I mean, people in other countries know that there's a resistance movement in this country, and they also know that the people who do support the president have been really subjected to very powerful propaganda by the government and by a cooperative media. So I just wanted to make that point about the complex feelings that people have about this country, difference between how they feel about the government and how they feel about the American people. As far as the possibility of a truth and reconciliation process, I mean, what are the chances of that? Well, It will take a major political change in this country for that to happen. In South Africa, it took the overthrow of apartheid and the election of Nelson Mandela to bring about a situation where you could have a reexamination of the crimes committed under apartheid South Africa. In the United States, it would take the replacement of the Republican and Democratic parties by a new political movement, which would then be in a position to examine American policies in the past, bring them out into the light, have this truth and reconciliation process to educate the American people and the world about what the United States has been doing. But as I say, It will take a very drastic change in our present relations of political power in the United States for that to happen. But I think it's something to work toward.
Professor Zinn, you had a column that was in, I think, one of the Miami papers yesterday. It was circulated on commondreams.org this weekend, calling for the United States to withdraw its troops from Iraq. Why don't you just talk, if you would, for a second about where the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, how that will you view that, put it in historical context, and what some of the implications might be of this war and occupation for the coming generation?
Well, you know, the war in Iraq joins a long string of American military interventions in the world. And after all, you know, we made war on Iraq, 12, 13 years ago, under the senior Bush, and we made war on Panama under the senior Bush a few years before that, the war in Iraq is, I think, especially vicious. Because it brings the most advanced technology of death into a part of the world where people are poor, where people are helpless, where we can march into Baghdad with shock and awe and kill tens of thousands of people, where we can destroy the city of Fallujah and send 200,000 people out of their homes and who become migrants and kill. We don't know how many people we've killed in Fallujah. This is one of the most vicious acts of American foreign policy in a long time. And so, you know, I think and I hope, you know, that future generations will understand that this was part of the long march of the American Empire, which had already done what it could to control Latin America, to move into Southeast Asia, now was trying to move into the Middle East and control the oil facilities of the Middle East for the benefit of the oil corporations and for the political profit of the president. The problem is that the media, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm speaking on a program which deals a lot with the media, that the media have done a shameful job in failing to bring across to the American people the human toll of our war in Iraq. Sure, we see the numbers of American dead. We don't actually see much about the American wounded, the amputees, the psychologically wounded. And we certainly see virtually nothing about the civilian casualties in Iraq. The Pentagon says it doesn't keep count. The British Medical Journal, which reports on very careful research done about civilian casualties in Iraq, and came up with a figure of close to, you know, 100,000 civilian dead as a result of this war. In short, that this occupation of Iraq has been disastrous for the Iraqi people, has been disastrous for the American people, in not only killing our young, but draining our resources. And so in the piece that you're talking about, Bob, that appeared in the Miami Herald, I'm saying that the United States must withdraw from Iraq because our presence there is absolutely deadly, deadly for democracy, deadly for liberty, and is doing no good for anybody in the Middle East, anybody in the United States, and the sooner we get out, the better.
How would you assess the state of the anti-war movement in the United States today?
Well, I think the anti-war movement is alive and growing. It's you know, a lot depends on how you define the anti-war movement. Because if you define it by the number of people who demonstrate, well, it's significant, but not overwhelming. You know, you get 1,500 people show up in New Orleans, you get several thousand people show up in Washington and San Francisco. If you measure the anti-war movement by the numbers of demonstrators, it's not enormous. But if you measure the anti-war movement and include those Americans who do not march and who do not demonstrate, but who have turned against the war, then you're talking about at least half of the American people. The public opinion polls have shown a steady decrease of support from the war, from 75% or so supporting the war when the war began, and now the number has dipped below 50%. So I would say the anti-war movement is growing. And it will continue to grow because the realities of the war in Vietnam, the absolute failure, I'm not talking about military failure, I'm talking about the moral failure of the occupation, has been coming through more clearly to more people in this country.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of callers, and I guarantee we'll get to all of you. We will also have time to take a couple more callers, I hope. The number, 1-800-333-9455 and the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Our guest again is Howard Zinn, author of numerous books, including the new book he's co-edited with Anthony Arnov, Voices of a People's History of the United States. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Eureka, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Thank you for your excellent guest. I heard him on C-SPAN, and it was one of the most refreshing things I've heard on Media Plural in recent weeks. I have two questions. Well, the first one would be, what might his view be on why such a large segment of the American public seems to have believed the lies about the war, and what may be the best strategy? And if I could just interject this comment, from what I heard you saying to three previous callers, if I don't want to mind read, but it seemed like you were talking about maybe a very poor way of teaching and understanding American history, and a passive media and government propaganda might be some reasons you might suggest why a large segment of the American public has bought hook, line, and sinker the Bush line.
You know, Howard, before you answer that, can I just sort of add on something that sort of, this leads naturally to a question I wanted to get to later, and, and I don't want, you just have to say the same thing. A broader question is, how does someone like George W. Bush win an election in view of what's going on in Iraq? I mean, what is the nature of our politics today in the United States that a president with this record can actually win an election?
Well, you know, you use the phrase, the nature of our politics, Bob, we have a political system which has no room for dissenters. We have a political system in which the American people go into an election with enormous stakes, that is, a war going on and people dying. And all they have to choose between is two candidates, both of whom, in their own different ways, support the war. So, I mean, it's not surprising that Bush won, considering several things, considering first that, you know, 40% of the voting population didn't vote at all. Second, he won because he has an enormous propaganda machine behind him. And third, because his opponent, John Kerry, did not present a clear alternative to the war policy of the Bush administration. So I would not call the election of Bush a mandate for war. I would not call the fact that he won 51% against a candidate who was not easily distinguishable from him. I would not call that a resounding declaration of support for the war. I would call it rather a weak representation of his position, and done in a political system which works to exclude dissident candidates.
You know, you're a historian, obviously, and we've had a two-party system in this country more or less for much of the country's history. And as you answered, I mean, part of the problem is that the two parties are sort of locked into a fairly narrow range of policy options on issues like war and peace. Is there a realistic way out of that two-party dominance, in your view?
Well, you know, there's an immediate, there's a short-term and a long-term answer to that. The short-term answer is that we're not going to get out of the two-party system for a long time. It is very, very difficult to mount a third-party campaign, given the dominance of corporate money in any political campaign, and given the tight control over the election process by the two major parties. This means that when social change comes about, it has to come about even with the existence of this terrible political system. It has to come about as a result of a social movement growing in the country and becoming powerful enough to frighten whoever is in office, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, to frighten them into thinking that they had better come across with concessions or they will face something more serious. I mean, this is what happens in the 1930s when you still have the two-party system, you have the Democrats and Republicans, and
but they worry about what will happen in the country with the rise of strikes and labor unions and tenants' movements and unemployed movements and general strikes. And so the system, even with its inadequacy, responds. Roosevelt responds with the New Deal measures. The Republicans and Democrats both have to take cognizance of the civil rights movement. It becomes powerful enough so that even with this bad political system, we finally, as a result of a movement which arouses the country and embarrasses the government before the world, we finally, you know, get legislation which does away with segregation in the South and gives the vote to black people. So I'm suggesting that, you know, in the short run, we'd have to, working with the obstacles placed before us by the two-party system, it places a responsibility on citizens to build a movement of social protest, of resistance, of non-cooperation, which will become strong enough so that whatever party is in power will have to respond to it. The long-range solution, of course, is a change in the political system, and that is, of course, connected with the first point, and that is we'll need to have a social movement strong enough not just to win an immediate victory like over racial segregation or the war in Vietnam, but a social movement strong enough to actually revamp our political system and bring into political leadership, you know, a whole new set of people who are not tied to the old conservative ideology.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today in Media Matters. We've got a few more phone callers I want to get to. Line 3, Farina, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi. I really want to thank you, Professor Zinn, for this great honor to ask your question. What do you think about the possibility of change by some type of citizens' lawsuits to impeach or remove or even imprison leaders from the president on down for things like war crimes, voter fraud, appointing criminals to government posts like in the case of Admiral Poindexter to the NSA, and campaign lies, and just lies in general, and also Congress members for writing and sponsoring unconstitutional bills or for voting on bills they haven't even read, and for buying votes or being bought, and lastly, suing the media for misrepresenting the truth to us. Thank you.
Oh, well, I like your spunk. It would be all of those people that you mentioned, and all of those groups that you mentioned, deserve to be put on trial. This connects with what the caller earlier had talked about, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. All of them deserve to be brought up before a tribunal, and all of their crimes, their war crimes, the crimes against the poor, their corruption, all of that deserves to be aired before the public. I mean, traditional lawsuits in terms of, you know, going into the courts today, of course, are not going to get very far because the courts themselves are seats of corruption. The courts themselves are become more and more handmaidens and of the administration from the Supreme Court down. But I think it's possible for citizens' tribunals to arise. I think that would be a very important thing to do. We need to create alternative institutions that may not get official recognition, but that arouse the public and tell the truth to the public. And yes, we ought to have a commission which impeaches Bush, even if Congress won't impeach him. We ought to have a commission which puts Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and Cheney and the others up on trial for war crimes, and just to bring that to the attention of the country. So, you know, I think your idea is a good one, so long as we see it as, you know, part of an alternative to going through what is called the due process, which is sort of an endless tangle of the judicial process, which usually goes nowhere.
Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I've been reading a lot about projection of power in the British and French empires, and I've been wondering lately about if the United States can be brought back from its imperialist stance without an opponent that knocks it off the perch, because it doesn't seem to me that there's been an example in history from the Romans and the Phoenicians through the French and the British, and then we inherit, even after the Russian Revolution, the empire didn't go away. And I wonder what your thoughts on that are.
Well, empires don't simply go away, that is, without something happening. But as you point out, we've had empires in the past, and those empires no longer exist. And all those from the Roman Empire down to the British Empire, you know, those empires disintegrate, and they don't simply collapse on their own. They collapse because they face resistance on the part of the people that they are controlling, and may have been able to control for many, many years, but after. There's only so much tyranny people will take, and then they will rise up, and then the imperial power has to withdraw. It was rebellions in Africa that finally caused, you know, the empires of the Belgians and the French and the British to withdraw from those parts of Africa that they controlled. And I think that it takes a combination of rebellion of colonial peoples and the overreaching of the imperial power, as the imperial power begins to spend more and more of its resources on trying to control its empire and creating economic disaster at home, which then leads to kind of resistance at home against the continuation of the empire. So, looking at the American empire, American empire obviously cannot even maintain control over a tiny, weak country like Iraq, and it was unable to control Vietnam, and it is unable to control countries in Latin America, which once it did control. So resistance grows, and the overreaching of the American empire today, the huge, huge debt which is being accumulated as money is being drained off for military reasons and taken away from the people of this country, all of that, I think, is going to, at some point, cause this American empire to dissolve. I don't know if the word is dissolve, disintegrate.
Be no more.
Yeah.
And Howard Zinn, before I get back to the next phone caller, I just wanted to, someone off air had asked me when they heard you were going to be on the show to ask you this question. A few years ago, as I recall, you had an arrangement to make a TV or film documentary out of A People's History of the United States. And it was with, if I'm not mistaken, with Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. Did that ever get made? Whatever happened to that project?
I'm glad you asked. Or I'm sorry you asked. No, the project fell through. It was a project that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck joined me in trying to make a series of films based on a people's history. And at first, the Fox television network, believe it or not, was going to do it, and they spent several years at it, and I don't know what happened then. I think Murdoch finally read my book. I don't know exactly what happened, but in that world, you don't get explanations. You just get a phone call which says, we're not doing this.
Mm.
And then I went to HBO, and HBO worked at it for several years and even hired screenwriters, and then HBO dropped it. Again, who knows why. So right now what's happening is a documentary group in New York is working on creating a documentary series, unlike the ones that Fox and HBO were going to make feature films, but this is a a documentary series based on a people's history. So that's in the works. That's all that's come out of that long saga.
Well, we've got four callers waiting patiently to talk to you. I'm going to really try to get to all four of them before the show ends. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yeah, these should be really brief answers, I think. One is it fair to say that in the cliche, we're a nation of laws, that's never included international law? And I've got one other question.
Why don't you ask them both, and I'll clear up the line.
Okay. And the last one is, since you were talking about the media last, I was wondering, what do you think of the History Channel? Thank you.
Nation of laws, you're perfectly right. International law has never stopped the United States from doing what it wants to do in the world. Well, for that matter, even our own Constitution, not just international law, but our own Constitution has been ignored by the government when it felt like ignoring it. And as for the History Channel, I don't really watch the History Channel, and I think that's because I'm a historian.
Okay. Line four, we've got another call from Farina. Boy, our ratings are booming down there. You're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi, and it's a pleasure to speak to you. Back to the Citizens Tribunal, or a commission, how would one get something like that started? Or could a and also, could a civil suit or a petition recall, how do we get the Republicans out of office, the administration out of office?
Well, when I was talking about a tribunal, I wasn't talking about one that would be officially recognized by the courts or by the government, because that's not very likely. I was talking about something that would be an educational activity.
Sort of like Bertrand Russell's war tribunal in the 60s?
That's right. There was a Bertrand Russell's war tribunal during the Vietnam War, which brought to light the atrocities committed in Vietnam. It wasn't official, but it was brought to the attention of a lot of people in the world. And I think that's the way we would have to do it this time, too.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. You're making real progress here. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. I was wondering if you would comment on an action of the New York Times in the past week. Apparently, the anti-war people had purchased a large advertisement to be published in the paper, which they did not do. And judging from their op-ed page, it was because they felt it was a time for national reconciliation and for drawing together.
Well, I mean, what hypocrisy on the part of the New York Times. National reconciliation? If they were in South Africa, under apartheid, would they call for national reconciliation and therefore not run an ad in the paper against apartheid? No, the New York Times is just being cowardly. If you look at the editorials in the New York Times, on the one hand, says, well, the war is not going well. We don't see any prospect of success. It doesn't look very bad. We have to admit that we did not report accurately to the public about wars of mass destruction. So what does the New York Times end up saying in its editorials? It says, well, we must recruit more people for Iraq. So what logic? Number one, it's a disaster. And number two, we need more people to go into that disaster. So when the New York Times doesn't publish the statement, really quite a strong statement, not in our name, asking the government not to continue this death-dealing war in our name, not publishing this, the New York Times is, playing, unfortunately, the role that the press has played for so long. Subservience to the government, not reconciliation, but submission.
At this point, it's probably worth noting that our guest on Media Matters next week will be Richard Falk, who has a new book out specifically on the New York Times and its coverage of the world. So join us in 167 hours for that episode of Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines for our last caller today. Line three, Lawrence, Kansas, you're on the air with Professor Howard Zinn.
I'm calling from Lawrence, Kansas, and I wondered, who are you looking for, Mr. Zinn, to replace people, not replace, but to continue to speak for the people, you and Bill Moyers and Noam Chomsky and some others are beginning to come to the end of their career, and I'm wondering who you look for to continue to speak for the people.
And do you want names?
Apparently he does want names.
Let me say this, first of all.
But you can answer however you desire.
Okay, we're not going. we refuse to leave until we see a profound change in American society. But second, there are so many young people, who are out there, who are writing, who are speaking, who are protesting, creative, interesting people. So I'm not worried about, Michael Moore and Chomsky and me and Barbara Ehrenreich sort of departing the scene and leaving a vacuum. No, there won't be a vacuum. Too many really wonderful young people in this country to carry on, and who already are.
Yeah, we've only got about a minute or two left, and I don't want to go through this show without going back to your experiences in the Civil Rights Movement and a lot of the writing you've done on race in U.S. history. What's your assessment of where our racial politics in the United States stand today compared to where they were 40 or 50 years ago?
Well, 40 or 50 years ago brings us, before the Civil Rights Movement. And I think it's important to recognize that change has taken place. The movement of the black people in the South that, in the 50s and 60s, and that movement has not failed. It has not done enough. I think it's important to recognize that what lies before the African American movement today is a question of economics. King recognized that just before he died, and that's why he was helping the strikers in Memphis, and that's why he was organizing a Poor People's Campaign. The crucial issue now is the unity of black and white people around the issue of changing the economic system, of using the resources of the country to abolish poverty and sickness and so on. I think that is the next job for a new, invigorated civil rights movement. And, I mean, we're not yet there. But I think that campaign is on the horizon, and in that lies the future of that movement that began back in the 50s and 60s.
And maybe the future of the country, for that matter.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much, Howard Zinn, for being our guest today on Media Matters.
Oh, well, thank you for having me here.
It's been a real honor to have you on the air. My name is Bob McChesney. I'm the host of Media Matters. I want to thank Victor Picard, our producer, for arranging today's show and doing the great job he does every week. We will be back 1 week from today with Richard Falk, 2 weeks from today with John Nichols. I look forward to joining you in those weeks. And again, Professor Zinn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champaign; Prairie Boat Works, Champaign; and Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning in Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming partly sunny with a high in the lower 20s and northwest winds around 5 miles per hour early, shifting to the south 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. The low around 16 degrees with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 30s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.